Thanks so much for being with us today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Really pleased to welcome back Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And, of course, she stops by second Tuesday of every month to talk with us about your pet's health and your pet's care. And I hope you'll join in. If you have a question or comment for her, please feel free to join in at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post a photo, post a pet photo or a question on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to see those pet photos as well. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here. Let's hope my voice holds out. You know, we're going to be talking about allergies today. And
you have one.
I have a feeling that I'm getting like adult onset allergies. Never bothered me before, but every year for the last couple of years, it's just been like, yep, this time of the year, you know, you get that post-nasal drip and everything else. But yeah, hopefully throughout the show, I can give some pointers on how to keep your pets more happy during allergy season.
Yeah. Are dogs or cats more susceptible to allergies, or does it vary from one
breed? It is probably equal between them, but we do know that there's a strong genetic component. So in the dog world, we see it a lot in different breeds of dogs. So that's the number one thing you can do is if you're out there in the market looking for a dog, try to find one that is not prone to allergies. So, you know, and so you got to look back at the parent's health history. If you're getting a mixed breed dog, different story. You don't have that ability to do that. But, and if you are a dog breeder, you shouldn't be breeding dogs that have allergic skin disease.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there let's say you've got a pet that's itching. Are there steps to keep the pets more comfortable?
Yeah, a few things. I mean, some of the more common allergens that we see are things like house dust mites and molds and things like that. So one of the number one things I tell people to do is throw out that dog bed, especially if it's made out of foam or whatever, every year. Buy your dog a new one. Maybe on your dog's birthday, give them a new foam bed. And all the bedding that your pet sleeps on should be washed 1 to 2 times a week in warm water to help get rid of some of the potential for having house dust mites and things there. Cigarette smoke, big one.
Mm-hmm.
Give up smoking or smoke outside of the home if your pet has allergies. And then even using like a HEPA filter, a HEPA filter vacuum would be even helpful. And then keep your house dehumidified, which is really helpful. In the summer, it's easy with you've got an air conditioner that's usually doing it.
Yep.
But keeping that dehumidifier going in the basement to help cut down on mold formation be really helpful.
June is Adopt a Cat Month, which I didn't know.
I mean, there's a month for everything, right? Last month was Dog Bite Prevention Month, and this is Adopt a Cat Month. And it's just to bring attention to the fact that there are lots and lots of cats out there that are looking for homes. And some of them are newborns that were born this spring, and there's a lot of older kitties that would love to settle into a nice home. But always remember, if you're bringing a cat into your household, you need to have the environment set up for it. It's not something that you just do on a whim. You've got to have litter boxes and scratching posts and window seats and things for the cat to be able to look out. And especially if you've got another pet at home, they need to be forewarned that pet's coming in. So you need to have a place to be able to isolate the new pet before you start letting them mingle. Real important. I'll maybe bring up later in the show a little story about a very sad case of somebody that adopted a cat and let it mingle with their cats a little too soon, and now we've got issues with a bad disease.
And we will get to that. But let's go to Brian in Rosholt. He's been waiting a bit. So, Brian, thank you for calling.
Oh, you're very welcome. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Oh, you're very welcome. Hey, doctor, I have a mixed breed, like a Siberian Husky mix. She's very anxious. She's 4 years old, and she just will not calm down. She's just afraid of everything. She paces. She's actually paced her pads right off her feet.
Oh, my goodness.
Her floor of bled. And it was kind of funny because I had to duct tape old tube socks on her feet with medicine to keep her off of them.
What is making her so nervous? Did you adopt her as a puppy or as an adult dog?
As a puppy.
Okay.
I think it's possibly she's been mixed bred somewhere in her lineage with either coyote or wolf or something, because she has the exact characteristics of one that is, if you were to cage a wild animal, that's kind of how they do that, back and forth.
Yeah.
She has moments of greatness. I've you know, my only other choice is to put her down. She's 4 years old, and, you know, she's my last baby. I'm not going to get another dog.
Yeah.
And, I just, I want to give her some sort of quality of life. And the vet did give me this one medication, which is kind of pretty much so made her extremely lethargic, but you can still see the fear.
Yeah, yeah.
And I read something about using lorazepam or Valium.
Yeah,
I was wondering, you know, she's about 75 pounds, so she's not little.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to give you doses over the phone because that would be something that your veterinarian would have to work out with you. There are only four anti-anxiety medications for dogs, two approved drugs for dog use, and then we do use a lot of human medications as well. Because it sounds like she's got compulsive disorders, the constant pacing to the point where it results in some self-mutilation type behavior, you may want to look into using one of the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and that would be like fluoxetine or Prozac. In the human world, in the dog world, it's given the name Reconcile. Sometimes we do use the human preparations. The other drug that we will sometimes use is called clomipramine. It's a tricyclic antidepressant that has very good anti-anxiety properties. And these are medications that need to be used on a daily or twice daily basis. You need to get a little bit of blood work done ahead of time to make sure that they're healthy and happy. And then a little bit of monitoring. They're very, very safe medications. And that would probably be the first route that I would go with. The other class of drugs that we will use kind of to piggyback with those would be one of the, what we call benzodiazepines or the Valium type drugs. And that would be things like the, you know, Xanax and Valium and lorazepam and clorazepam and all these other ones that are out there. And so, you know, those are ones that you probably don't want to have your dog on a daily basis. They can be physiologically addictive. And so we typically, you know, only use those kind of as rescue therapy if you really need to give your dog something. So, you know, typically we do that for dogs that are maybe thunderstorm phobic as well as having other phobias. But number one thing, too, is there's no pill that's going to fix her behavior. You really need to work with somebody that could perhaps come to your home, see what's up with your dog, maybe give you some tip, you know, pointers on how to desensitize her to some of the things that she's really afraid of.
I've done that already.
Yeah.
They said just put her down.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure who you saw. You may want to consider getting a second opinion, but just know that there isn't a medication at all that is going to cure her. It's going to take combination of probably medication and behavior modification.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Susan in Oregon, on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I actually groom dogs, and I have two questions that are really related to what you're talking about and very pertinent. I had a dog in yesterday that's a mixed dog. It's a Shar Pei Mastiff Beagle.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to have the Shar Pei problems with allergies, and it's still a young dog, less than a year old, and the owners have tried many things as far as altering the diet. And I was suggesting that the dog maybe should have the screening, you know, blood test to find out what it's allergic to, because I said, you know, even though it costs a lot for that screening, you might be having this dog in your home for, you know, 15 to 18 years,
right,
and it would be good to know what the allergies are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how much that type of testing would cost.
It depends on the lab that you're going through, but I think it runs about $125, $150. It does not work for food allergies. That's even though some of the companies will include different foods and things on the blood screen, it's pretty useless information. Some other things that I already mentioned earlier in the show about like washing the bedding and things like that, the fact that this dog has more kind of Shar Pei-like thing, that makes in its makeup, it makes me wonder, does this dog have anything else going on that's causing this as well, such as a secondary infection? When you've got all those wrinkly type, you know, folds and so on, they can get secondary yeast and bacterial infections, and those need to be diagnosed and treated aggressively. And other simple things that they may find that would be very helpful for their dog too is just by bathing the dog with a mild antimicrobial type medicated shampoo that they can get from their veterinarian. And it's unfortunate, but every 3 3 to 7 days. You want to do it probably at least weekly to a couple of times a week, which depending on the dog, that may be a little bit of a problem. But make sure that they are doing something like that just to kind of cut that bacterial load on the dog's body. And it also helps wash off some of the allergens that could be there that are triggering this. And then if they aren't using flea control monthly, and I mean monthly, even when there's snow on the ground, keep them on flea control. You'd be surprised how many times people don't even realize they have some fleas in their house, and all it takes is one flea bite to trigger this. So monthly flea control as well.
And could I ask another question?
Sure.
This dog also is deathly afraid of water and grooming. And I was suggesting even to the client, I've only groomed this dog twice, and its anxiety has increased rather than gotten better. And I was suggesting maybe talking to the vet about, is there some kind of a calming medication that the dog could receive maybe an hour before the groom?
Yeah, probably even the last caller was talking about this. My guess is that the dog was probably prescribed something like acepromazine, which is a sedative. That does not have any anti-anxiety properties, but it will turn the dog, depending on the dose, into a little bit of a pancake where it may be difficult to groom because they may not be able to stand up real well. But my experience with it is that most dogs that are fearful are going to override that it may be helpful initially, but if they're really, truly anxious, they're just going to override it and be back to their old selves again. So then we get into all the anti-anxiety meds that we could consider using as well, that I mentioned. So in this case, if it's just going to be an intermittent thing, having them on one of the benzodiazepines, and again, this would be a prescription product that would have to be given by the veterinarian. And the issue with that drug, though, is you don't want to use it in dogs that are aggressive. So some dogs that are fearful are fear biters. And if you give them a drug that takes away some of their inhibitions, and the benzodiazepines do have that disinhibition effect, it can cause the dog to maybe want to bite faster. You really have to get a good behavioral history before you just start handing drugs out.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Susan. Appreciate your call very much. Jeanette in La Crosse, what's on your mind? Hi.
Hi. I was calling because we're babysitting presently a neighbor's dog, a little Chihuahua terrier mix. And it started out, they didn't have time to walk her, so we started walking her. And in the meantime, she got really attached to us, and she doesn't seem to hardly want to go home anymore. And the family is moving, and so we're babysitting her for a couple weeks, and she learned to use our doggy door so she could go in and out of the house and go to the bathroom. And then just recently, I don't know what it could be related to, but she just, like yesterday, she just went in one of the side rooms that we don't use much and peed and pooped.
Okay.
Is that anxiety, you think? Or
probably not likely, unless it's actually you're witnessing that. It may just be that you may not be 100% housebroken. I'm not sure. I mean, I think you have to look at, does she have any other medical issues where she's got urgency? I assume that the stool and urine were normal, that you're not noticing anything like frequency, having to go outside more often or whatever. But you always want to get medical problems off the table, like urinary tract infections, intestinal problems or whatever. And then you start looking at, okay, was it that she was left alone and is anxious because she's got separation anxiety? And it may, the fact that she's gone from her owner to your house, there's a lot of upheaval in her life. That potentially could be it. But I think you don't really have enough history without having the owner saying, yeah, every once in a while, the dog goes to the bathroom in my bedroom. And not a lot of people want to admit that to their pet sitters.
Right.
So it may just be that she's like just not, really well housebroken. And you just, she just decided that was absorbent and easy to get to rather than having to go outside where it's what yesterday was, hot and windy and so on. And that may have been enough to say, hey, I'd rather go in here where the air conditioning's on.
Hmm. Well, can I tell you one real quick thing? A happy story.
Mm-hmm.
A person that I work with told me Thursday that morning he saw some kittens in the highway, and someone evidently they got so big and they dropped them off in the road, and he didn't pick them up. I could have strangled him, but that's another story. And so I asked him where exactly he saw them. So after work, my husband and I went down there, and we combed the grass line along that area, and by mewing, I actually found them, three of them.
Oh, good for you!
Yeah, they were hiding in the ditch, and one of them actually had a fractured leg.
Oh.
But she's getting treated, and I think we found them all because I was, you know, I didn't hurry. They probably thought this crazy woman meowing in the ditch. But that's another.
Oh my goodness!
But we found them all, and so there are real happy stories out there too. I just wanted to share that with you guys.
Well, you are a very good Samaritan, and I hope all those little kittens find homes. So good for you.
Yeah, good for you. Thank you very much. For calling. Appreciate that call. What a great story.
You know, I was driving home last night from work, and I saw a car pulled over on the side, right where you can go from the Beltline in Madison onto the interstate, and it was like a weird spot for someone to stop. And there was a woman standing and looking down in the ditch, and I'm going through my mind, I went, I wonder if that was her. Kind of a busy, busy spot to have kittens let loose, yeah.
Thank you very much, Jeanette. Appreciate it. Susan in Janesville. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
How are you today?
Great. What can we do for you?
I have a poodle mix, and I had her tested for worms, and her anal gland is good. And she chases her tail and pulls out the hair of her tail. And then I also forgot to mention that she does have seizures.
Okay. Well, and so you're wondering why she's pulling the hair out on her tail.
Yeah, if you would have any idea.
Yeah.
I got her from the Humane Society, and she had been abused before I had got her.
Yeah, you always want to rule out medical issues, things that could make the tail irritated. So are there any skin conditions back there? Was the tail ever fractured where there may be some painful sensations and, you know, where they're getting kind of that phantom nerve pain that people will get if they've, had issues with, losing a limb or, digits or something like that. And you're right, checking for, the anal glands. Usually dogs that have anal gland impaction are going to scoot. There are very few parasites will make a dog chase their tail. Tapeworms may, as they crawl out of the anus, make the dog scoot or turn around and lick their rectal area, but it's not going to really cause them to chase their tail. So then that opens up, if there's nothing medically wrong, is it a behavior problem? I mean, we do know that some dogs do chase their tail compulsively and grab it and will sometimes cause some self-mutilation. Very common behavior problem in bull terriers, in German shepherds. There's certain breeds of dogs that if we do see a compulsive disorder, that's usually how it presents in that particular those particular breeds. So
she
that
does
might
have a docked tail.
Okay, and it may be that it's bothering her. If it maybe wasn't docked correctly, there's a little piece of extra vertebra back there. Again, talking to your vet about maybe taking an X-ray to see, is there anything, some osteomyelitis or something going on in those bones in the tail that could cause her to be uncomfortable. And then the other thing you said is that she has seizures. It's probably unrelated, but you can get what are called motor seizures, focal motor seizures, where it may just involve twitching in one part of the body or weird sensations or something. And although I've never seen a dog chase its tail with seizure disorder, stranger things have happened. And that
think that that's a separate issue.
Okay.
Yeah.
But with their tail being docked, I think it's worthwhile going in and saying, let's just get an X-ray of the tail and just see if there's any bony changes there that may be something that needs to be taken care of, such as maybe re-docking and doing it correctly.
Well, there you go. Thank you for calling. Susan, appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest here, Judith Sears-Poisson, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, our producer. Thank you for listening and stay with us. If you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you will join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page. You can certainly post a question there or a photo there at the Larry Mueller Show. And I see Chippy the Chipmunk is back. He was here a couple months ago.
Yeah, and I just, Very cute pictures on Facebook, by the way. But just so you know, remember, wildlife is wild. And if you are in a situation where maybe you have had a big windstorm and there's some baby animals around, you know, don't take it upon yourself to treat them. I think there are licensed people that can do it. We don't even do it at the vet school. We don't do wildlife.
Oh.
So they usually, we either send them to the Humane Society or someplace where they are licensed to be able to handle wildlife.
But there he is with his cat.
Yeah.
It's unusual to have a cat and a chipmunk.
It is. But, you know, again, you can have cats that are just, they don't have a predatory drive, and that's great that they can get along like that.
Nick in Oshkosh. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a 2-year-old male German Shepherd, and he's been recently diagnosed with exocrine pancreatic insufficiency.
Very common in the breed, yep.
Yep, and we have him on a powder, and he's a pretty sizable dog, not as big as some German Shepherds, but he only weighs 68 pounds.
Okay.
We've had him on the enzyme for, I believe, 4 weeks now. And while his stool has hardened up, we're feeding him 5 cups of food a day, and he's put on about 3 pounds, but not anymore.
Okay.
Is there anything that we can do to help him gain weight? I mean, we can see his hip bones and we can see his ribs without him moving.
Yeah, and this is a common problem in German Shepherds and other breeds too, but very common in German Shepherds. The pancreas is made up of two parts. One that makes enzymes that are released into our intestinal tract to digest food. And that is what's the problem with your dog, is they're not making enough of these enzymes. And so the food basically goes in and was not getting digested. And so the fats didn't get digested appropriately. Proteins didn't get digested. And so they usually have greasy, sloppy stools and losing weight. And, you know, that's kind of the classic presentation. The other thing the pancreas does is makes insulin. That's a totally different thing, but your dog doesn't have that as a problem. I would assume that maybe your veterinarian has done some a gastrointestinal blood panel. If they haven't, I would suggest that be done. When we have had issues with them not digesting their food properly, that can sometimes throw off the bacterial growth in the upper small intestine, and it's called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, SIBO. And we send off blood samples to a gastrointestinal lab that's in Texas, and that's where that gets run. And so I would hope that's been looked into, so that if your dog does have something like SIBO going on, it can be treated appropriately. And it may just be a matter of time, too. I mean, for dogs that have this problem, you really can't feed them the performance food, the high-fat diets, because they do have this digestion problem. The fact that the stool has normalized, it may just be a matter of time of you know, just getting those calories into your dog in a slow, gradual manner. And eventually they'll be, you know, hopefully back to normal, but it does take time. It's not going to happen overnight. And the fact that your dog is gaining weight and not losing tells me that you're on the right path. But talk about your vet about getting a cobalamin and folate level done on your dog. I think that's real important.
And good luck to you. Thank you very much for calling. Judy in Burlington, it is your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Just a question. We had a dog. He was Australian Shepherd and Border Collie. And he got a tick in July of 2011. So Frontline Plus was recommended.
Mm-hmm.
We put Frontline Plus on him on August 9th of 2011. And he must have been allergic to it.
What did he do?
He started out, he lost some hair, then he got, it looked like psoriasis all over his body, then he lost all of his hair on his back, from the back of his head down to his tail.
Wow.
Boy, oh boy.
Yeah, we had taken him to UW-Madison and said it was calcinosis cutis.
Okay.
But he had had no problem until then.
Okay.
Until the Frontline Plus.
Yeah, yeah.
So we ended, he just kept going downhill over a period of time, and we finally had to euthanize him.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It was such a heartbreak.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a rescue dog, he had been abused, and then, of course, we got him, and he had some good years, and then it just killed us.
Yeah, I mean, it's a that would be an extremely uncommon response to a topical medication. We do know that we do see dogs that sometimes can be hypersensitive, and you may see focal areas where the hair may thin or they'll be itchy in that spot. There's been a few products that have been associated with causing an immune problem called pemphigus foliaceus, PF. And one of those products was one that has actually been pulled off of the market. I'm trying to remember what the name of it was. And it was made by a company called Fort Dodge, and that was on the market up to a couple of years ago. And so, you know, there are, uncommon reports of things like that showing up. You still have to be concerned about tick control, though. And there are lots of different products that are out there that are not a fipronil-based product. So in the future, if you do get another dog, talk to your veterinarian about what other things can we use to control ticks that, since I've had maybe potentially a bad experience with fipronil, which is the active ingredient in Frontline, and there are lots of other fipronil-based products out there, so you're going to have to learn to be a label reader. But it's still that particular type of medication I still recognize as being very, very safe. I'm sorry you had a bad experience, but hey, you know, even things like, you know, different lotions and hair dye and stuff for people can sometimes trigger pretty severe reactions as well, and you just never know until you give it a try.
No, you don't. And you were discussing using flea, you know, something for fleas all year long.
Yes.
And, of course, I know fleas are horrible because they give dog worms, they do all kinds of bad
things.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, because I'm looking at a rescue dog, and I don't want to harm this dog
right.
in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Of course, my favorite is the Australian Shepherd.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I love those dogs.
Yeah.
And so I just don't want to hurt this dog.
But I cannot keep up with some of all the new products that are out there. In fact, I just got a big envelope filled with stuff from a brand new product by the Merck company that's out, and I really don't know anything about it. I'll talk a little bit more about it next month. It just came in the mail. Whole unique way of the product doesn't have any effect on the dog. It has to be in the body of the flea, and the flea enzymes activate it, and it kills the flea. Something weird like that. I only read the first paragraph or two and went, woo, this looks like I'm going to have to do a little homework on this one. But when you do get another dog, please, rather than just going over the counter and buying medication or going online, I think this is an important enough topic for you. You need to talk to your veterinarian, and they can go through all the different ones that are out there. You may find that an oral flea product, a pill that you give orally, there's one that's called Comfortis that very safe to use unless your dog is on. There's a couple of medications you have to be careful of, but very, very safe medication to use. And that may be one that would help you with your, any flea control. Doesn't give you tick control, so you've still got that as an issue.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling, Judy. I appreciate your call very much. Sarah in Zion, Illinois, turning to you next. Hi, Sarah. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks to you. Okay, I have a cat who's, I think, about 7 years. I adopted him when he was a stray, who came to my back door. That was like 5 years ago. And he's a great cat. He seems healthy in every way, except that ever since I've had him, he's kind of had this low-level throwing up issue, but it was just not very often, like 2 times a month maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then, last year he... I was feeding him canned food, and he started throwing up, and I decided he was, like, ate it too fast. So then I divided his portions up, and that seemed to solve the problem. He didn't then he went back to his, like, occasional. And then like, a few months ago, he seemed to eat his food really fast again because I had been gone for a long time. So So I adjusted for that, and that seemed okay. But then this week, for no apparent reason, he's, like, thrown up, like, 3 times in, like, 4 days. And
okay.
I'll go to the vet if I have to, for sure, but I'm just wondering.
Yeah. Well, vomiting is one of those things where the list of causes is as long as my arm. And I think a lot of people would like me to just say, oh, it's hairballs, give him some hairball medication. But cats, most cats, can ingest hair. They may throw up the odd you know, wad of hair. But if it's that frequent, then we start looking at, are there other underlying medical problems? And the best place to start is a good physical exam by your veterinarian, where they can check your cat's weight. And we always compare it to previous weights to see if the vomiting is resulting in some weight loss. Bring in a stool sample for gastrointestinal parasite evaluation. And then your veterinarian may suggest that you have a little bit of blood work done. Because your cat was a young adult when you adopted it, you're really not sure of its age. There are some conditions, things like hyperthyroidism, that can present with a healthy, happy, normal cat with a great appetite that just vomits frequently. So they may want to screen for that, and things like kidney disease and liver disease, to make sure that there isn't something going on outside the stomach that could be resulting in vomiting. Then we start looking at, well, is there something in the stomach that's causing it? Did he swallow something that's acting as a foreign body? Does he have a huge hairball in there that's not coming out? Does he have some type of a dietary hypersensitivity? Does he have a stomach, you know, some type of infiltrative disease like lymphoma of his gut, GI lymphoma, all kinds of things. And that's where you start going down the line of the, what I call the GI extravaganza, with, you know, taking x-rays and maybe an ultrasound of the abdominal cavity, scoping, biopsies, and so on, to try to get down to it. I don't know where it's going to happen with your cat, but I think the first step is get in, get a good physical exam done, get that stool checked, maybe a little blood work, and hopefully that'll provide you with answers and your cat some relief from its vomiting.
Yeah, there you go, Sarah. Thank you so much for calling, and good luck. And another Sarah from Franklin, this time with us, Sandy. So let's go there. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I have a kitten who's about 8 months old. We got him from the Humane Society. We believe he's got a lot of Maine Coon in him. Very rambunctious, very athletic, loves to go after the feather teaser, and will do four-foot leaps and somersaults in the air. If he's been playing real hard like that, he will sometimes start panting. And I'm just concerned that you know, he's really athletic, and so maybe it's just because he's overheated.
Mm-hmm.
He might have a heart condition.
Yeah, well, without having a stethoscope attached to your ears and listening to the cat and knowing what you're hearing, this is something that your veterinarian could tell you for sure. Does he have some type of underlying heart disease? So listening for heart murmurs, dropped heartbeats, you know, anything that's abnormal that way will, you know, point you in that direction. But, you know, again, being a really, sounds like a super active cat, and how good of you for providing your cat with an outlet for its energy like that with toys and things. People just don't realize how much cats need to be played with. People get dogs and they know, okay, I got to take them to the dog park, got to walk them. A lot of people get cats and it's just like, yeah, here's a catnip mouse. They throw it in the floor and nothing gets, you know, the cat's not going to chase it very long. So most cat exercise does involve having a human at the other end of the toy. That may be all it is that you are just giving him a lot of exercise. He's getting a little warm because it sounds like if he's got a heavy hair coat, if he's got the Maine Coon type coat, that may be all it is. Remember, cats don't have the ability to sweat like we do. The only place they can sweat is through the bottoms of their feet. So that's where they're going to lose extra body heat. So they have to pant to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
So hope it's nothing.
Yeah. Thanks, Sarah.
Can panting be normal?
It can be normal, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Can be normal. We'll also see it in the clinic when cats are just so distressed. They'll start, you know, doing some open mouth breathing when they're perfectly normal. There's nothing else wrong with them. But we'll also see that in cats that have underlying heart and lung disease. So, you know, if your cat needs to go in, it's, you know, go in just for a quick, you know, peace of mind visit and have a physical done.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sarah, for calling. Sandy in Duluth, it's on to you now. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Fine,
great.
Thank
you for calling.
Good. Say, we have a 12-year-old male Shih Tzu that's been having some pretty serious incontinence issues. And so they did a urinalysis, determined there was bacteria, and are treating him with antibiotics as if he has a UTI, but it doesn't seem to be resolving. So my question is, what do you think would be the next thing to do to try to determine the underlying cause of this incontinence?
Yeah, it's uncommon for male dogs to be incontinent. It's just because of the way their anatomical makeup is. It does happen. So I would be looking at, he's an older dog. Is he drinking more water than he can hold back? Is that one of the reasons? And so, you know, besides getting a urine sample, I think you should be looking at getting a urine sample and looking at his concentrating ability of his urine. Maybe at this point, if they haven't done any baseline blood work, ruling out things like Cushing's disease, which can cause them to drink more, urinate more, and have a urinary tract infection. So sometimes that may be part of it as well. Also be, you know, looking if that all comes back normal and his blood work's normal, then it may be time to be saying, okay, well, why has he got an infection? He's a boy dog. We don't see infections very often. We don't see incontinence very often. Does he have something like prostate disease, a bladder stone, something in his belly, you know, in his urinary system that could be causing him some trouble? So an x-ray, rectal exam to evaluate his prostate, an abdominal ultrasound, if nothing's seen on x-ray, to look at the organs a little bit further. So I don't think you're finished yet with workup. And it's just when I get a boy dog in with a UTI and incontinence, it's like alarms start going off that there's something deeper going on here. So
they did do blood work, and the calcium was slightly elevated.
Okay.
Not the ionized, but the regular
calcium. The regular calcium. So yeah, they did do ionized calcium. Good. Because that's the true one that you have to look at to be able to determine, is he, you know, truly hypercalcemic? Because, again, when that calcium level goes off, again, more alarms go off. Does he have cancer someplace in his right. body that's making him produce a hormone that's causing his calcium level to go up? Or, you know, there's all kinds of things like that that we start looking at. So it sounds like your vet is right on the ball, but I think the next step is, you know, maybe some imaging or something to be able to see what's going on in that bladder.
Yeah, yep. That's what we're getting signed up for tomorrow. We'll have
okay.
Good.
So I just wanted to make sure that's the same track you thought.
That's exactly what I'd be doing.
Okay, well,
good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest here. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We really appreciate it. And thanks for the pictures and photos we're getting on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. William sent a couple of shots of his Border Collie and Lab, and man, don't they look happy.
And, you know, his dog, Coffee, is a 12-year-old Lab, and it, just looking at him right now, I can say it looks like the dog's in amazing shape. No white face or anything,
no.
And it's like, oh, to be 12 years old and that happy, that's great. Oh, there's a little bit of white hair in there. Or maybe it's just snow. Who
maybe
knows?
Maybe it's just snow.
Yeah.
Kelly sent us a Facebook question about cats. They have a cat that's mostly an indoor cat, but enjoys going out to the screened-in porch. Husband takes her outside a couple times a week for maybe 15 minutes. Do we need to treat her for fleas, ticks, and other pests? If so, what do you recommend? She's about 5, spayed, no problem.
Okay. I've had people that have had cats that they've gone outside and they've never gotten any parasites, but all it takes is, you know, you having a raccoon or a possum. Those are probably the big transmitters of the fleas that affect our dogs and cats. Come by at night, hang out under a bush, drop some flea eggs, and then your cat's out there later. These fleas are emerging and looking for a warm body, and there your cat has fleas. So I think it's you know, very inexpensive insurance to keep your cat comfortable and healthy and happy to use something topically. Cats, I don't see ticks on cats very often. A lot of times I think cats groom them off faster than they get a chance to start feeding. But if you're in a heavy tick area, cats typically are pretty resistant to tick-borne diseases, but, you know, so I don't get too worried about tick control that much. Heartworm disease, it can be fatal for cats, and there's no treatment for it, so having them on some type of heartworm preventative, especially if you're in a yard, your yard is, you know, has a heavy mosquito burden, that's how it's transmitted. And intestinal parasites, they're transmitted through the soil. So if your cat's walking or sniffing around in the garden, they could potentially be picking up parasite eggs on their feet, and they groom themselves, and there you go. What are my favorite products to use in cats? I like, just because cats, if you want just one thing that's going to kind of do everything, there's one called Advantage Multi that you can get through your veterinarian, and another one called Revolution. And they're both applied monthly. They're little tubes of spot-on product, very safe to use, and I think it's just good insurance, and that'd be something to talk to your veterinarian about and find out what they carry in their clinic or to get a prescription online for it.
Very good. We also had an email from Terry in Winnicottie. They have a skipper key. At his checkup in January, the vet said you might have a partially paralyzed vocal cord that can be a problem in hot weather when panting to cool off. first noticed that his bark changed from a moderate range bark to quite high pitched. Thought it might be a sore throat. Didn't go away. And when we take him to the vet's office, he always hyperventilates, so it's hard to diagnose his problem.
Yeah, yeah. When it's not the typical breed. The Schipperkes are little dogs, and this is probably more common, what we call laryngeal paralysis in large breed dogs. But what this is where the vocal cords, every time they breathe in and out, they have to move out of the way to allow air to go in. And so some dogs that lead a very quiet indoor life, they're not exercised much, kind of like my two bulldogs that are laying at home on the sofa waiting for me to come back.
As we speak,
yep. Can get by with, especially if it's just maybe one side that's just kind of flapping in the breeze. But if you have a dog that has this and they're exercising, imagine trying to get air. And that's the only way dogs can cool themselves off is through panting. They just can't physically get enough air past that obstructed larynx. And so they're forcing air against those vocal cords. They're going to become more swollen, which is just going to spiral this problem out of control. So how do you diagnose it? Well, if your veterinarian wants to, they can give your dog a light plane of anesthesia and use a laryngoscope and go in and actually watch the vocal cords moving as your dog is breathing in and out and seeing if they are moving. I think it's a good idea to have that done. We had a dog in just not too long ago that we thought it was, you know, fit the typical picture, large breed dog, voice change, you know, distress, a little bit of distress when it was hot, humid weather. So we did this, you know, procedure, knocked the dog down with a little anesthesia, had a look in there, and there was a big tumor in the laryngeal area. And so a very different diagnosis than what we thought. So I think it's a good idea to get that looked into so that you know how to proceed with your dog. And surgery can be done to repair it if it is laryngeal paralysis.
Mike in Shell Lake has a question for you, Sandy. Let's go there. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you. Pretty simple question, I think. I'm looking for an opinion. I have a 2.5-year-old English setter, very healthy, good coat, good skin, no problems whatsoever. I've been thinking about doing what I've heard referred to as a sport clip for
okay.
the summer. We're out training almost every day, and he goes for a swim almost every night. And of course, it takes him a while to dry off, and he comes in the house at night. I'm wondering what the pros and cons are of doing that, if there's any associated health risks.
Oh,
I've heard exposure to sun or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, if you take a lot, if they have really pale, light-colored skin, and you know, and setters do typically, that could open them up to sunburn. Potentially. But I think your dog may be more comfortable if it's got the typical feathers and so on that go along with the setters. Having all those feathers cut to allow them to, you know, dry a little bit faster, not bring burdocks in, your dog may be a lot more comfortable. But that shorter hair on the trunk actually acts as a little bit of insulation and keeps sometimes cooler air there as well. So you know, kind of, putting my hands up in the air. What do you do? You know, leave the hair maybe, the shorter hairs on the body, trim off the feathers, and let your dog have a continued wonderful life, being able to train and swim and do all those things.
There you go. Sounds yep. like okay. a... Yeah. Sounds like a wonderful deal for the dog.
Yes, I know.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're thanks welcome. A lot, Mike, for calling. Great owner there. Suzanne in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi to you.
Hi. I have about 7 or 8-year-old. It was a stray, so I'm not really sure how old it is. But he's periodically gets a drippy nose and cold symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And because I keep him inside all the time,
mm-hmm.
and I don't expose him to other animals, I was wondering if he could contract that from humans.
Well, there have been the odd cat that picks up, and this reported when the H1N1 or virus, the influenza virus, was you know, really concerned about it, and people were coming down with it. There were some cats that did pick it up, so it's uncommon, but it could potentially be that. But it presents much more, differently. It would be probably more lung involvement. Fever, I mean, really, you know, feeling under the weather. You know, a drippy nose for a cat, that, and especially if it's just like clear discharge. It's not yellow or green. I mean, that could just be something, a little nasal irritant if there's smokers in the house or they put their nose someplace, that didn't belong. It's also possible that, you know, if your cat was exposed to a virus such as cat herpes, also known as rhinotracheitis, as a kitten, many, many cats are exposed from their mom. They just pick it up from mom, and some of them will have some mild symptoms. Some don't show any symptoms at all. But it can, just like our herpes, recur over time, especially if they're a little stressed. Most of the cases we're going to see involve the eyes. They'll develop some eye changes, squinting and draining from their eye, but it can involve the respiratory passages as well. So that may be what it is, just a recurrence of a virus that is just never going to leave your cat's body, because that's the nature of herpes.
Hmm.
So
would he get inflamed ears as well? His ears are warm.
Yeah, they no. The
perceived to be warmer than they should be.
Yeah, no. The ears are should not get inflamed with anything. It's usually respiratory passages and eyes, and you're not going to see any ear involvement. So then you start wondering: is there some type of an allergic reaction going on if the cat's ears are bothering them? So maybe talking to your vet about going down that road of, you know, should maybe I try my cat on a mild antihistamine or, you know, something, because, you know, maybe your cat's being exposed to something and that may make them, you know, just symptomatically feel a little bit better.
Thanks for calling, Suzanne. Appreciate it very much. Josie in Sheboygan, hi to you.
Hi, good morning. I have a kitty that is about 4 years old, Panther, and he is allergic to flea bites.
Mm-hmm.
And also I've noticed over the years that it seems harder and harder to get rid of fleas. Even if you spray, you know, I got spray from the veterinarian type. It's very high cost, but it's supposed to be really good, and still they come back, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not, like, infested, but it only takes one or two if they're allergic.
Yeah, and so what you need to be doing is looking at where these fleas are coming from. There's several possibilities. I would be, first of all, looking out in your backyard. Do you have stray cats, raccoons, possums, that type of thing that could be dropping flea eggs in your yard? Or do you have wildlife that's living in your attic? Or are you feeding animals on your deck? Are they getting into your trash?
Because
if you are, that's probably the source. Remember, any flea you find in your house came from an egg that was laid about 3 weeks ago or more. Spraying your house is going to maybe help get rid of fleas that may be in your house. But I hardly ever use environmental sprays anymore, because if you're using good pet control, using an adulticide with an insect growth regulator, and that would be something like Frontline Top Spot Plus, or, you know, some of the other products that are out there, and again, your veterinarian could help you with picking an appropriate one, they're usually very, very effective at killing the fleas on the pet and preventing any new ones from being able to hatch in your house. But I'm worried that maybe you're bringing them in from outside if you're, you know, just walking through the grass or doing some gardening. Yeah.
I have two dogs, too, that go outside.
Yeah.
And my cats are inside kitted, but I have two, and one of them likes to escape once in a while when I open the door.
Yeah. So all your pets need year-round flea control, all of them.
He's been dipped in lime sulfur.
Okay.
At the vet a couple of times, and then now I'm going to go get some today to dip him here at home, because that's not a difficult task.
Yeah, lime sulfur is typically not used for treating fleas. It has some anti-itch effect. We usually use lime sulfur for two different things. One is ringworm, and then the other one is a Demodex mite that cats have that can be killed by that as well. I'm not sure what your veterinarian's concerned about why they're using lime sulfur, but I'd question them as to, you know, what do they think the diagnosis is?
Where it's like he would go into this frenzy. It's so itchy that he would start biting himself. It's right near the rear end.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He would
I mean, I've never seen it in my whole life. I'm 67.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I've never seen this in any of my animals. I mean, I know that other animals are allergic to fleas.
Yeah.
And it can kill them. But this, you know, and then they dipped in twice and it went away and he was playing. He was his, in fact, he was like bald.
Yeah.
Some area where it was really sore. Mm-hmm. It came out with this clear liquidy, a little bit.
Well, it sounds like your veterinarian's like looking at into everything, but you know, for flea control, year-round flea control period for all of your pets, avoid feeding wildlife in your backyard. Definitely try to get rid of wildlife that you may be out in the backyard. And then, you know, when it comes to this single cat that's this itchy, it could be allergies to something else too. So talking to your veterinarian about using something like cyclosporine or Atopica, we use that in cats, very effective for long-term allergy control.
And if you have a cat, if you have a couple of dogs that are going in and out, and
your indoor cats still need to have flea control because they can be bringing fleas in.
They're going to bring those.
Right.
For sure, bring them in.
Definitely. Definitely.
So there you have it, Josie. You need to...
This is why I live in Wisconsin, and I don't want to live in Florida, because every call would be on fleas. And here, it's just happens to be today's show, but, you know, we don't see them as often as other places in the world do.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She's our guest right up until 12:30 today, so stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, if you're like me, the animals that are part of your family are very important to you, and you want to keep them healthy and happy. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We're really happy to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine here for the next half hour to share some new information and give some timely advice. And whether you're a lifelong dog owner or you can't imagine life without a kitty on your lap, Sandy is ready to answer your questions when you phone in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page out at The Larry Mueller Show for updates, the news, and photos. Lots of photos today of people's pets, and they're really fun. Click like when you're there, and we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. Please do that as well. Stay with us. News is next. Once a month, on the second Tuesday of the month, we have a chance to talk with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She's with us today and ready and willing to answer your questions about your pet's health. As we visit with her, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. You know, we've had some comments or questions about alternative products to Frontline, some of the natural products. I know there's one called Natural Defense by Century.
Yeah, unfortunately, there has been no documented evidence that these work. Most of the research on flea control is done independently outside of, you know, from the industry that makes it. They contract through various, you know, teaching hospitals or parasitology departments and so on. And last summer, I spent a week in Kansas and actually got to work in a flea colony. I know it sounds weird, but they actually grow fleas. They have cats and, you know, and so on that they collect fleas from, and then they test these various products and see how they work. And none of the natural products have been found to be effective.
Mm.
Even though people will say, I use it and it works, that's an N of one, okay? So you always want to look at, you know, is this backed up with, you know, a documented proof that it is effective? And unfortunately, the stuff that you really want to use that smells good and natural may not be the best. In fact, some of the natural products are actually more toxic than the other ones. Like there's a DL limonene, a lemon-based one, can be extremely toxic if cats are overdosed with it.
Oh.
So, yep.
All right. Darlene in Saginaw, Minnesota, it is your turn. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about a 12-year-old Swedish Valhund. And for the last 4 weeks, he hasn't been able to do much with his legs. I took him into the vet, and everything is clear, his blood work and everything, and they can't tell me what's wrong with him. They suggested I take him down to St. Paul for a CAT scan, but unfortunately I can't do that either.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, would a sonogram give a little more information than an x-ray? Because we x-rayed his spine to make sure, you know, everything was okay there.
Imaging the back can be a little tricky. When we have dogs that are paralyzed, you know, first of all, going through a thorough neurologic exam to try to localize where the problem is, and that would mean checking reflexes and looking at, you know, other things on the neurologic exam to try to pinpoint, okay, this is where the potential problem is. Getting x-rays is going to be able to show you the bones. It may show if there's a disc or something like that, or, you know, any changes that are outside the spinal cord. But because the spinal cord is made up of soft, you know, tissue that isn't going to be picked up easily on x-ray, then you're looking at doing other types of imaging. And you can do what's called a myelogram, which is injecting a dye that is picked up on the x-ray into the fluid that surrounds the spinal cord, and then taking x-rays to see if the spinal cord's being squashed, and whether, you know, sometimes there's certain characteristics of things like spinal cord tumors versus discs that, again, help us with knowing what's going on. A CT scan is not going to be helpful. I mean, it may be a little bit, but it's not the best modality for backs. An MRI scan is going to be your best. An ultrasound is not going to be helpful because it doesn't go through bone. And so you have to go through soft tissue. And because that spinal cord is all encased in bone, the vertebra, you're not going to be able to have a look at it with an ultrasound or a sonogram, as you mentioned. So I think you're probably looking at, you know, trying to do your best at, you know, getting to the vet school or a neurospecialist to be able to have this evaluated more thoroughly.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Pam in St. Germain. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just had a question. I have two dogs. They're German Shepherd mixes. And a previous dog who passed away last year. And they've all done the same behavior where they basically search out oak bark and to chew on and eat. And it's only oak bark, and they treat it almost like it's a treat.
Uh-huh.
They sometimes argue over it. And
oh, my goodness.
I was wondering if you've ever heard of anything like that, or if,
Well, a lot of dogs like to chew on mulch, especially young dogs. I mean, they'll pick up anything that's in their mouth, and because you know, mulches can sometimes be a little fermented. From their point of view, it may be quite tasty. You have to be really careful because some of those molds and things could potentially cause health problems for the dog. And there's certain types of mulches that can be toxic for dogs, such as the cocoa bean mulch. You want to avoid having that in your yard. It really has a nice chocolatey smell when you first put it out, and the dogs can like it too. And there's enough still of the active ingredient to make dogs chocolate toxic. So be careful with that. If they're just going in and finding trees where it's coming off, well, obviously that's bizarre. I mean, I don't know why you have three dogs. They've obviously taught each other that.
That's what I think. Because we just got our newest dog from the shelter, and she learned from our other dog that this oak bark is very tasty. And it's they actually look specifically for the oak bark.
Wow, wow.
That's really weird.
Very, very weird. I mean, just be on the lookout for, if they're ingesting a lot of it, gastrointestinal distress, foreign bodies, you know, vomiting, having difficulty passing stool with splinters and things. I've seen, you know, chunks of wood and things being lodged in the roof of dogs' mouths or between the gum and the tooth and causing some dental disease. So, you know, be on the lookout maybe when you're out in the backyard, providing them with something that is even more tasty, you know, like, you know, rawhide chips or something like that may deter them a little bit from going after that stuff just because there's a potential for it causing issues.
There you go.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And Kathy in Appleton has an issue to raise. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. How you doing? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm a just like your thoughts on declawing adult cats.
Okay. This is a hot topic in the veterinary world, and if you were living in England, this would not even be a topic because you cannot do it unless there's a medical reason for it. Mm-hmm. So I always ask, well, why are you asking the question? Do you have a cat that is being destructive, that you can't trim its nails, or why are you interested in declawing?
Well, I just got, my daughter had two cats and they weren't getting along, so I have inherited a lovely little kitten.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she's an adult, but very small. And I love everything about her, but I've never had a cat before, and it is an issue with furniture because she is scratching. I have three posts everywhere, and she just really seems to take into furniture.
Okay. The nice thing about furniture is that it doesn't move. It's sturdy. It's shreddable. It's right. In a prominent physical spot where, because remember, why cats scratch? They're scratching primarily for, I think, about three reasons. One is to hone their claws, and that's probably pretty minor. Number two is to leave a visual mark behind. That's that frayed fabric so that when somebody walks in your front door, they can say, oh, you must have a cat. They're also leaving their scent behind as well. And so if you are providing the cat with the scratching post, and your cat is preferring the whatever surface is on your furniture, that's what you need to try to do. So a couple things. One would be either temporarily eliminate that furniture from your home, put it in the garage, in another room, whatever, so that she doesn't have contact with it. In that location, because that's a real prominent social location, obviously, put a scratching post there that is covered with the same type of material that she's been scratching on previously. So go buy some fabric or upholstery remnants and staple those to your scratching post. The post needs to be tall and sturdy, and so it should be 3 or 4 feet tall. And most cats do not like to scratch on things like carpet. They may, you know, some of them like the sisal rope type things. So that would be, you know, if you had to look at a commercial scratching post, making sure you've got one that is tall enough that they can get a good drag, sturdy enough that it's not going to tip over, and again, covered with the surface that they prefer. And once she starts kind of leaving her scent behind and getting that shredded, they will continue to go back to that. If removing the furniture from your home isn't an option, then covering it up with something that will deter her. There's a product on the market called Sticky Paws, which is basically a really super duper double stick tape that is safe for your fabric, but it's going to be uncomfortable for the cat when they put their feet up there. It's like flypaper.
I have that. I did purchase that, and I'm in the process of taping everything.
Okay. You know, bubble wrap, carpet runners that have the little spikes on it, so that, again, it's going to be a different surface that is not going to be able to hold her odors or, you know, be something that she can shred and leave a visual mark behind. If all else fails, then you can be thinking about declawing. Okay, so that's my kind of my opinion on it, that you try it. If it doesn't work, then you do this. I mean, I know, Larry, you've had your cats declawed. I've had a cat of mine declawed, especially when I was my daughter was an infant, and I made that personal choice to do it. But for an adult cat, if you're going to do it, do a laser declaw rather than the standard surgical declaw that is done using a blade of some sort. They tend to heal faster. It's less painful. And make sure you're working with a veterinarian that does do post-operative pain control as well. So kind of, you know, do your homework a little bit about, you know, the different types of surgery that are out there.
Okay. And I shouldn't try the spraying of the spray bottle of water, like, to discourage her?
You know, that's just going to become an owner absent problem then. She's going to know, okay, mom's not around, claw the furniture, or she'll just do it on the back of the sofa where you can't see her, because she's still, all cats are going to have that desire to scratch. And that's one of the things when you introduce a cat, you need to provide them. So in your case, before she even had the opportunity to scratch on your furniture, I would have said, okay, what's her past life been like? You have your daughter. You can, you know, ask her, was she scratching anything? Then cover your sofa up, and that's where you put your scratching posts. And most of the commercially available scratching posts are useless. They are absolutely useless because they're tippy. They're covered with, you know, plush carpet. They just don't work very well. So you may even have to have your design your own and have it built.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, I will give it all a try.
Okay,
all right,
good
thank
luck.
You. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kathy. And Carla in Hudson, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi. I have a cat, Snickers, who's about a year and a half, and I got him at about 5 months old, took him to the vet because just doing his initial shots and things.
Uh-huh.
And I asked my vet about the balance and perception problems that I was seeing, because he would, as a young kitten, take a run from, let's say, a dresser to a bed, which might be 2 feet in between, and he'd fall in between the dresser and the bed. Or he'd take a running jump to the couch and hit the side of the couch and kind of bounce off.
Okay.
And I even saw him roll off a ledge, like a window ledge. So I asked her about that, and she didn't think there was anything neurological wrong. She thought it was just that he was learning to use his tail.
Okay.
But a year and a half or a year later, he still has some of that. It's definitely improved, but he will still at times try to run up onto the sofa and not make it.
Okay. Very strange. Because most cats are quite agile. And, you know, when cats get older, they sometimes run into troubles with arthritis and they can't jump as far. Or an overweight cat is not going to be able to make the same leaps as they did. But it doesn't sound like that's an issue. There's a couple of neurologic problems that can occur in cats. One that can present when the cat was affected. There's a disease called panleukopenia, cat distemper, that can affect a part of the brain called the cerebellum, which is involved with controlling their movements. And it, with very mild cerebellar disease, they may, you know, just not be able to judge space real well and so on. And so they you know, may fall over at times. But what you may see is them kind of doing a goose stepping gait, or when they start to eat, they may have what we call an intention tremor, where their head's bobbing a little bit. And it can be very mild to extremely severe, depending on when the cat was affected. So watching for any little, you know, things like that. Making sure your cat's vision is normal, doing a good retinal exam to make sure that there's, you know, nothing going on, like juvenile cataracts or, you know, retinal changes secondary to different diseases or inherited problems. That could be potentially causing this. You know, in the house, cats don't need a whole lot of, I mean, if they can see enough to get by, but, you know, when they have to fine tune their vision, that may be where you're going to start seeing it. So is that the problem? Or do you just have a clumsy cat that is like, you know, and that may be all it is that there's nothing medically wrong, and it's just a cat that is not the brightest, you know? So
He also seems to be, like, he's really foldable. Like, I hold him and he kind of, it's almost like I would describe him as a human, he would be double jointed.
Okay.
And if I'm holding him and I, you know, drop him to the floor, you know how cats always catch themselves. Well, he kind of splays out sometimes.
Yeah. So there's something wrong. I mean, he probably has some minor issue with balance, neurologic issues, you know, but, you know, getting a video of him of doing this kind of behavior, maybe something that you could take to your veterinarian so they can, you can say, here's what he's like when I'm trying to put him down on the ground. There's nothing worse than trying to do a neurologic exam on a cat in an exam room, because they just freeze and they don't want to move and they don't want to walk. And so we may not witness the same thing that happens at home. So maybe that would help your veterinarian with getting a diagnosis for you. Not that you may not be able to do anything about it, but at least it may provide you with some answers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And some more photos up. This is a kind of a cool photo Libby sent of their wedding photo.
Oh.
They had their dogs involved in the wedding,
yeah,
which is cool.
Yeah, that's becoming a big trend because, you know,
is that
so many,
right?
Yeah, it is. And there's actually wedding planners that specialize with weddings involving canines.
Ah.
So I read it somewhere, probably People Magazine or something. But yeah.
Who would have thunk it? Denise in La Crosse, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I'm calling with a question about a Boston Terrier.
Mm-hmm.
She is 6 years old. And she's always had a problem with, puking when she gets really exciting.
Okay.
Excited. So if someone comes over to visit, or if she is playing, or if she, right after she eats or drinks.
Okay.
She'll vomit up whatever's in her stomach.
Okay.
And that happens on walks. It happens pretty much you know, all the time when she gets excited.
Weird.
And, yeah. And even just after she eats, if she, you know, jumps down from the couch too quickly or, you know, it happens quite frequently.
So a question I have for you is, and you may not be able to answer this, is it vomiting or is it regurgitation? And here's how you tell the difference. Vomiting is actively compressing the abdominal muscles. I'm sure everybody who's ever had the flu or drank too much or whatever knows what that is, where you're doing, and so you can tell that they're nauseous, they may start drooling, their abdomen's contracting, and they know that something's coming up because they're standing there with their mouth open and up it comes. Sorry, I'm making all these sounds while people are eating their lunch. Regurgitation is very passive, and that usually happens when we have food material or fluid in the esophagus that has not made it into the stomach yet, and then the dog just opens their mouth and up it comes. And there's no, like, you know, heads up that this is going to happen. It's just almost instantaneous. And I'm not sure if you've, you know, paid that close attention. It sounds like if you've cleaned it up as many times as it sounds like it's happened, maybe you've watched her. Do you think it could be regurgitation?
Yeah, it sounds more like that. I mean, there are times where she visibly does, like, the, oh, it's coming up, I'm going to puke kind of thing. But most of the time it is just like comes out.
Right. So go to your veterinarian and say, my dog is regurgitating. Here's what it's doing. It's, you know, and describe it like I just said, you know, where it's just a mouth is just coming open. I mean, all dogs are going to vomit every once in a while. And so that's probably why you're seeing kind of normal vomiting. I mean, if their tummy's upset, they ate too much, something happened that way, that could potentially just cause them to vomit. But the fact that this is happening with excitement, with walking, with just jumping down, you know, often regurgitation is involved with like the position that the head's in. It's just gravity allows the stuff to flow out and up it comes. The risk to your dog is that they can aspirate this material. When we're vomiting, our body actually closes off our windpipe so that we can't inhale. When they're regurgitating, their body doesn't have a time to react like that, and that material that's coming up can be inhaled and cause problems. So take your dog into your veterinarian, ask them, do you think it could be regurgitation, and then get chest radiographs done to look at the esophagus. They may want to send you someplace if they don't have capabilities of doing this and doing a barium swallow or, you know, contrast study where they can actually see if the stuff's getting into the stomach in a timely manner or if there's some kind of stricture there.
There you go. Thanks, Denise. Greg in Whitewater, quick question from you.
Yeah, I have a Brittany Spaniel that is skin and bones, and I'd love to figure out a way to help him gain some weight. I do take him out for walks, and he runs like crazy, so I know he's healthy.
But
put weight on.
Yeah, so things that you'd want to look at is the quality of diet that you're feeding, the amount of food he's eating, whether he's just a normal skinny adult dog that's just his normal set point, or, you know, and so if maybe you can, change things a little bit with your management, and then looking at other reasons, you know, is he absorbing his nutrients properly? Does he have a pancreatic problem? Does he have a, you know, parasite problem that is not allowing to absorb nutrients? So workup of a dog that's slender, we just start with kind of the basic stuff, you know, evaluating the diet, looking at past weights and maybe doing a little bit of blood work, stool sample checking, and taking it from there.
There you go.
Yeah.
Good luck. Thank you. And just in the last minute, to go back to the beginning of the show, we talked about introducing cats.
Go slow. Keep them in separate rooms before you let them mingle. I had just the heartbreak of a client that had brought a new cat in, let it mingle with two other cats, and the new cat has feline leukemia. And now we're looking at, do these other cats potentially, are they been exposed? Do they have it? So keep them separate until you can get them into your veterinarian. And that also helps with the social adjustment as well. Rather than just springing a new housemate on a cat, let them learn that there's another cat behind the door and have a little bit of a dating process going on before you let them mingle. So,
yeah, I think we took, with our current cats, they were almost immediately together and loved each other.
They were young and they liked each other. But before, you had an older female and you introduced an outside street cat that,
that took several months of having them separated.
Right,
it was a long process.
Yeah, you just don't want fighting to start because it's probably not going to end.
And thank you so much. You'll be back second Tuesday of next month.
That's right.
Thank you very much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. And she'll be back in a month, almost exactly a month, and we'll just do this all over again. Just to take a look at what's coming up tomorrow at 11 o'clock, we'll talk with Stephen DeWald. After 31 years as a conservation and a warden in Wisconsin, he's written a memoir, and it's really interesting. I'm having fun reading it. So that's at 11. Then 11:45, Darren Bush talks with us about trends in the paddle sport industry and efforts to get more young people involved. Stay with us. Thanks for listening here on the Ideas Network.